song through its doors, just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. I'll lock my heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes, and I'll see you with my heart.
Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky.
For thought-provoking dialogue and talks that penetrate Orange County and beyond, listen to Subversity on KUCI 88.9 FM and webcast at KUCI.org. That's Subversity with your host, Dan Tseng, each Monday at 9 a.m. on KUCI.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
Darling, you say you want to write a book? Well, then you must listen to Writers on Writing, darling. Authors, literary agents gabbing and babbling about the art and the business of writing. Thursdays, 5 p.m., darling, you must. Barbara DeMarco Barrett, she hosts. Yeah, listen, darling.
On KUCI FM in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org.
And hello again, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents. And everyone's discussing the art and the business of writing. And today I have one guest, Leila Narji. She's an author and freelance journalist who writes extensively about food, travel, and knitting. Her latest book is Around the Table, Women on Food, Cooking, Nourishment, Love, and the Mothers Who Dished It Up for Them, published in June by Torture Penguin. She's also author of Knitting Lessons, Tales from the Knitting Path, Torture Penguin, 2003, and All You Can Eat, published in 96 by the Princeton Review. She has essays all over the place, and she also has a book that she edited called Knitting Memories, Reflections on the Knitter's Life. She lives in Brooklyn, and let's bring her on. Hi, Layla.
Hi, how are you?
Great, how are you doing?
I'm well, thanks.
Talk about Around the Table, first off, and excuse me, how this, the idea for this book came about.
Well, it's funny. Today, this evening, I'm sitting in the home of a very dear friend of mine talking to you on his phone. He's a poet named Denver Butson, and we've been friends for a good long time. And the idea for the book, even though the book is all about women and their relationships to food, really started with him. Over the years, we discovered that we would, anytime that we got together and would be sitting around just talking casually, the conversation always came back to food somehow. And the first interview I really did with a project like this in mind was with Denver. He had grown up in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, on a farm and had all kinds of stories about what that was like. And we realized as we spoke that this was one way that we really got to know each other, not just what we felt about food, but a really sort of deep and penetrating way to know each other and know more meaningful things about each other.
So then the idea came, and what did you do with it? I mean, how did it sort of form in your mind that it would be an anthology, that you would have it be, you know, essays, including recipes? How did all of that kind of come about?
Well, as often happens, I think, in the publishing world, there are a few different stages, some of which are a little bit muddled in my mind now. I think that I never really wanted it to be an anthology, and I wouldn't call this an anthology either. Every woman in the book I interviewed, with the exception of one or two where it wasn't convenient, and they contributed fully written pieces. But I had a very particular, I wanted to ask the same questions to, you know, a group of women. Well, a group of people. Actually, the idea for it being only women came later with my editor, who thought that was a great hook, just to be talking specifically to women and see where that led us. And in fact, she was right. It was. So a little at a time, I started putting out the feelers, seeing who might be interesting to talk to. I happen to have a lot of friends who were interested in food and who cook a lot and are interested in different issues around food, and one by one, you know, one person would lead to another, which is what's always so much fun about these books, is that it almost becomes effortless once you start. One person leads to another, and this person knows somebody else, and then while you're meeting that person, you're meeting somebody else, and they get drawn into it too. So it really becomes like a giant conversation.
Mm. And you also write about food. You write quite a bit for different publications about food.
I do some, less these days now that I've had a daughter and spent all my time fighting about food. But yeah, now and again.
So, food and knitting.
Food and knitting, yes.
How did that evolve?
The food has always been something of great interest to me. It's played a huge role in my life. I had a mother who cooked when I was a girl. Quite a lot. She made very elaborate meals, and it was really a huge part of growing up for me. And then when I had my own daughter, I guess I realized really what the significance was and what I wanted to pass on to her. Knitting happened in a kind of strange way, and that was that I had learned to knit as a girl, and then a few years ago, had the urge to learn again, and a friend was going to teach me. And just as I was learning to knit, another friend who was an editor had this idea to do a book about knitting, because it was very much in the air, and she thought that it was a good moment to be writing about knitting and asked if I would be interested in doing such a project. And as it so happened, I was learning to knit, and I was interested, and I had noticed the same thing myself, that it seemed to be suddenly everywhere.
Well, yeah, your book, Knitting Lessons, when I started to knit a couple of years ago, as you know, it was the first knitting narrative that I picked up that it seemed to be only one of a few, actually.
Yeah.
And now there are many more, but it was, you know, it was one of few that I saw. And what I liked about it so much was just the tone, and it was, you know, the style. It was a literary, sort of a literary narrative, as opposed to, you know, a book of patterns, which I also love, but, you know, it was something that I didn't know really was out there.
Right.
You know, our idea of knitting, at least my idea of what the material was not this book.
Right. Well, I think you're right. I think there wasn't a whole lot out there, and then the Knit Lit books came out, and now it's kind of crazy. I just got back from an event, the Knitters Review Annual Retreat, where, you know, people are talking about knitting mysteries, and this whole, like all these other genres that have, like, grown up around knitting. But I think for me, people are always kind of perplexed when I say I write about food and travel and knitting, and I always put it in there last. It's sort of the kicker to see what people will say about it and to see their surprised reactions. But mostly I write about my experience or the experience of other people, and I, you know, food, knitting, these are creative endeavors, and I think if you write about anything from your own perspective, it's not so much about that thing, like knitting or about food, but really trying to get at the heart of, well, we all have questions that we try to answer in our writing, I think. And for me, it's these the things that make us, the small stories that make us who we are and that connect us to each other.
Yes. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm talking with Leila Nargi, author of Around the Table, Women on Food, Cooking, Nourishment, Love, and the Mothers Who Dished It Up for Them, and Knitting Lessons, both published by Tarcher, also Knitting Memories, Reflections on the Knitter's Life. Now, getting back to the whole genre of anthology, so did you need to create sort of a book proposal, perhaps, you know, the sort of book proposal that's created for, I don't know, prescriptive nonfiction, narrative nonfiction, and get sample essays and put the whole package together to do this book?
You mean specifically for Knitting Memories, I guess.
Knitting Memories and Around the Table, I guess.
Yeah, it works pretty much the same way that it does for anything else you put together a proposal. I was lucky with Around the Table because I had already published one book with Tarcher and with this particular editor, so I had a lot of help. I'm not going to say that I can go in there and write a really dynamic proposal that's going to get somebody. It's a whole other category of writing and marketing yourself. And then Knitting Memories, I had been working with this publisher previously in Minnesota. There was an editor at Voyager Press who had excerpted some stuff from Knitting Lessons and had asked me to contribute some pieces to anthologies that she had put together. And so she had actually approached me and asked me if I had any ideas about a book. And for a while I didn't, and then one day I did. And I approached her and did a very simple proposal, as I recall, and I think there was one essay, and it may be actually an essay that I wrote. It may be the essay that kicks it off. And that was enough for them.
How nice.
Yeah, very lucky.
Yeah, really great. And at what point did your agent come into this mix?
There's no agent involved in any of these books, actually.
Uh-huh, okay. Well, that's another interesting thing, because I think most writers, most authors to be, think that you absolutely need an agent to get a book published.
I wouldn't say that you don't need one. I often do need one and do have one here in New York. But it's so funny how compartmentalized agenting has become. If you have an idea for one kind of book, you need one kind of agent, and you approach that agent with your idea. If you have an idea for a children's book, you approach another agent. If you have an idea for, you know, a blockbuster nonfiction, you know, there are different agents doing different things. It's not so neat as a pin anymore, where you have one agent who can fulfill all of your needs, and it becomes a little, I don't know, I find it a little frenetic. Everybody is correct in the assumption that you don't get paid as much without an agent. That's definitely true, and there's stuff that an agent can do for you in terms of being your advocate. But I've so far found that these books have sort of fallen into my lap. And for future projects, I will indeed use an agent for particular things.
Hmm. Yeah, it's true, though. When you have an agent, if you come up with sort of an idea that's a little different from perhaps what, you know, the book you did with them, and they don't like the idea, then you're left with the question for yourself, well, is it a viable idea, or do I just, you know, flatly believe them and go on to the next one?
Well, and there's something else happening in publishing, too, that I find really frustrating, which is that... you know, the word platform gets thrown around a lot. Oh, well, if you want to do that kind of book, you need to have a platform. If you want to do a book about, you know, about motherhood, you have to have a platform where you've written for all these mothering magazines, or you're, you know, a child psychologist, or you have to have a platform. And it's such a strange view of publishing, to my mind. There's certainly books being published still out there by people who are just good writers, and I hope to continue to see a lot of good writers out there. I frankly find the whole idea of platform to be really boring. I think there are only so many celebrities, at least I'm willing to read, talking about random topics, just because they're celebrities, you know, so.
Yeah, and then it seems that with the whole idea of platform, it could get to the point where you're writing books that you don't necessarily feel passionate about, but now you have the platform, so you better keep writing them.
No, it's true, and that's something that happens too. You know, I have an agent who's like, well, we need to think of, you know, the writing's there, we just need to find you the right project. Well, you know, finding the right project, you know, on the one hand, you have the idea that you love, and people tell you that you can't sell it, and so you start to feel demoralized, but you believe in the project, and you believe in yourself, and you believe in this work of yours. And on the other hand, you can spend an awful lot of time trying to find the, quote, right project, and just not really believe in it, and, you know, cross your fingers and hope that this will be a runaway success, and then you can live with yourself afterwards, you know. So I don't know. I debate this very question often.
Yeah, I think so many writers are just caught up in wondering exactly what to do, and then, of course, you'll come across an agent who says, forget about platform, it's all about the writing.
Right.
Like, that's the agent I want, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Where is that agent? They can call me anytime.
Oh, yes, I love agents like that. Getting back to Around the Table, will you read to us from one of the pieces?
Sure, I will. And this is just a little bit of a piece by a woman named Nancy Butcher, who is a young adult novelist. She has quite a number of books out, and she's written about food issues, too, and I've known her for some years. I know her through Penguin, and she wrote, I interviewed her. I interviewed her, and she's half Japanese and half American, and she spent the first few years of her life living in Japan before her mother upped and moved her and her brother to Ohio. So this is Nancy Butcher. These pieces don't have titles because they're not written, they're just interviews. So, Nancy Butcher. One of my ultimate favorite foods is natto. I buy packs and packs of natto at a time from the Japanese supermarket to mix with raw quail eggs and scallions and soy sauce and maybe a little bit of hot Japanese mustard. Natto is fermented soybeans. It's dark brown in color and very, very sticky. It has a pungent smell that many people, both American and Japanese, find offensive, in the same way some people find especially pungent cheeses offensive, but I happen to love it. I think because I used to eat natto all the time when I was a little girl in Japan. My mother would mix natto the way I do now and serve it on top of rice with shredded nori seaweed. I loved watching her crack the raw egg and the sound of her chopping scallions on the wooden cutting board. In Japan, rice is the main staple. It goes with natto and everything else. Gohan is the Japanese word for cooked rice, and it also means meal. Growing up, I had rice for breakfast, rice for lunch, rice for dinner. The thought of a bowl of white rice is the best thing on earth to me. Some people eat mashed potatoes for comfort, or macaroni and cheese, or buttered toast. I eat plain white rice. I love the rich, buttery smell of it is cooking, the plain, hot, simple taste of it. I love how it is a vehicle for other things. Natto, tadako, codfish roe, served raw or roasted, umeboshi, which are pickled plums. When I was a girl, I used to eat all kinds of things with it. I used to eat rice with butter and soy sauce. I used to eat rice with a raw chicken egg and soy sauce, rice with pickles, and of course, rice with natto on top. My mother used to pack onigiri, rice balls, for my lunches, which were shaped with something inside them, such as umeboshi or bits of salmon or tadako, and wrapped in seaweed. rice definitely does something for me emotionally, and I'm not sure it's entirely healthy. I've written about food issues and trying to lose weight. One of the things the experts say is that you should never eat because you're depressed, because that's when you tend to overeat. I usually follow this advice, but in my less than healthy moments I don't, and sometimes they even border on binge eating. But I think there's also a gray area where eating is not necessarily healthy or unhealthy. It's normal and familiar and comforting to go for something that satisfies an urge or a hunger or a need. If I feel a little bit blue, I put raw rice and water in my rice cooker, turn it on, and then savor the sound as the steam begins and then the click when the rice is done. I have an old, dented Japanese rice cooker that I've had for 20 years with a lid that gets gooey as the rice is cooking. My mother bought it for me when I was in college. She was appalled that I didn't have a rice cooker in my dorm room along with my hot plate and toaster oven. The smell and the taste of rice just takes me back, much more tangibly and powerfully than reading a Japanese poem or seeing a beautiful silk kimono. I smell rice cooking and suddenly I'm 6 years old and I'm happily eating a bowl of rice in my cozy bed.
I loved that piece. I think I made a note somewhere that I wanted to go out and buy natto after after I read it.
I try it too, and I've been waiting for Nancy to eat it with me, and it's just we haven't had the time yet.
Yeah, that was a wonderful piece. So it's interesting that with this book, and I imagine with knitting lessons too, you did interviews and then wrote up, basically wrote it in the person's voice that you interviewed.
That's right. I think that for Around the Table, there was a lot more editing going on. Knitting lessons, there's some interviews that they read like straight interviews, and mm-hmm. There's plenty of interviewing going on there too. But for Around the Table, I really wanted less for it to be conversational than for these pieces to be able to stand on their own.
Interesting. So then what do you do with a person's voice? Because in reading Around the Table, I imagined that these pieces sounded like these people, that they mm-hmm. it wasn't your voice, it was their voice.
God, no, I would never want it to be my voice, ever. And it's funny, there's some people in here and Around the Table that I've known since college, Charlotte Gould in particular, and it's so funny, I read these pieces and I can't, the words and the tone and the cadence are all theirs. It's so, to me it seems so clear.
Hmm. Yeah, I find that really interesting. And then with a book like Knitting Memories, Reflections on the Knitter's Life, you're dealing with other people's pieces mm-hmm. and editing them and hopefully helping the writers to sound even more like themselves.
Yeah, and it's tricky sometimes, too. And I think what happens with the editing process, too, is that I think that, you know, in every book, in every anthology, there's one person who, as you go along, you tend to forget to explain yourself as well as perhaps you should as an editor, that what you're doing really as you're going along is making suggestions and pointing out places where you see opportunities for things to happen, much in the way I think that a writing teacher would point out to people, you know, where the strong points are and where things can be tightened up and where changes can happen. And hopefully people take cues or find their own places. You know, everybody's going to have, it's always so subjective, isn't it? Everybody, the writer is going to have a different perspective from the editor, and then for each reader, every reader is going to have their own opinion. But certainly what you hope to do as an editor is bring out a person's particular voice, because otherwise, what's the point?
Yeah. And then, but how about the overall project, like Knitting Memories, for instance, where it's a book of pieces by people who may or may not know each other, but certainly they wrote their piece with only themselves in mind, and whatever topic they told you they were going to write about, or that mm-hmm. you said, yeah, you're writing about this. How do you then put the whole book together? I mean, do you then order the pieces so that one sort of builds on the next, or...
Yeah, I hope that they do. I hope that they have a momentum of their own and that it makes sense as you read along. What's funny about that question that you asked me is that Knitting Memories was not my title. The original title was Living with Knitting. And it was all based on the essay that I wrote for it, actually, called Living with Eleanor, and this blanket that this friend of mine who taught me how to knit had made that I won, that she raffled off. And living with this blanket and trying to sort of decipher things about her and our relationship by looking at this blanket. And the idea came to me to have other people contribute on this particular topic of living with knitting. And when I put out the call for submissions, I was purposefully a little vague. I gave the title that I wanted, which got changed, which is a little complicated to explain when you see this title, and in some ways the essays don't make sense without the original title. But I wanted people to interpret it in their own way. I wanted to see what would develop. I wanted to see what other people's interpretation of that little phrase were going to be.
Interesting. Something I want to talk more about when we come back. We're going to take a real short break, so everyone out there, stay with us. In just a few minutes, we'll be back with more Leila Nargi and Writers on Writing, so don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like 1,000 years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
Get the lowdown on the publishing industry. Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett. She talks to anyone who's anyone in publishing. Thursdays, 5 p.m.
on KCI-FM in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KCI programs, visit KCI.org or KCITalk.org.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at KUCI.org, and we are also podcasting these days. Almost 100 shows on the podcast. So if you go to iTunes and you look under, I think you go to radio and then public KUCI, click on it. You'll be there. You can listen to the show on iTunes. If you want to listen to the podcast, you have to look it up on iTunes under Writers on Writing. Or you can just go to my website, which is penonfire.com. You click on the radio tower, brings you to the radio page, and at the top of the page, there's all kinds of links to help you get to the podcast. And this show will probably go up in a couple of weeks, and so many recent shows are up there now. Go listen and take advantage. It's wonderful, actually. I hear from people all over now that I have the podcast. And I did before, too. Every so often I get an email from somebody from Tasmania or here and there that heard the show. But now with the podcast, I'm hearing a lot from people in London for some reason. I don't know what it is, but people in England all over the place are writing, talking about the podcast. And it's just, I always say, how'd you find it? Well, I went to iTunes. Anyway, my guest today is Leila Narji. She's author of Around the Table, Women on Food, Cooking, Nourishment, Love, and the Mothers Who Dished It Up for Them, published by Tarcher. Also author of Knitting Lessons, Tales from the Knitting Path, published by Tarcher. And Knitting Memories, Reflections on the Knitter's Life, published by Voyager. Hi, Leila.
Hello.
Another question, actually, about Knitting Memories. You were talking about it before. And Voyager is a new press for you, a departure from Tarcher from these two books. And so what was the process of submitting the proposal like, because they were a new press? Did you have to go through anything sort of differently than you did for Tarcher for your second book?
Well, as I think I said before, this Voyager kind of fell into my lap. There was an editor I was working with there who's a crafts editor named Carrie Cornell, and she does a lot of knitting books, actually. And I had submitted, she had approached me to contribute some pieces to some anthologies that she was doing,
mm-hmm.
and then asked if I had any ideas of my own. They were actively looking for people to write knitting books for them. And then I had this idea, and I emailed her and said, I have this idea, and she said, great, what is it? And I did a very scant proposal with an essay that I wrote as the writing sample, and I think just a pretty sketchy outline, maybe a page, maybe less, outlining the idea, and that was it.
Right, okay, and that was Living with Eleanor, that essay? That's in Knitting Memories.
Mm-hmm. And I just—you were asking me before about editing these things. I just wanted to say too that that in these books, it's not really like journalism. It is in that you never want any facts to be inaccurate. You want to make sure that everything that shows up is accurate about the people and that things are spelled right. So, for two reasons: one, because it is like journalism, and you want to have the facts right, you let anybody who's contributed, either with an interview or with a written thing, have a read, have the last word, not only for factual accuracy, but because you want them to feel that it's their piece and that they have the last word about everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important that people feel like that it's theirs, that you haven't taken it away from them, and that they're going to see everything that happens before it goes to press and know exactly what it's going to be like.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's the sign of a good editor. No major surprises, you know.
Right, well, you don't want anybody to be mad, and plus, yeah, it's just you want to work with people again, and you want to be diligent and responsible.
Yeah. Now, you had mentioned titles, that you had a different title for this book, and that you didn't, that I think you said you felt that Knitting Memories doesn't really relate what the book is?
It's a pretty broad idea. It works just fine. They are Knitting Memories, but the original title that I had in mind, no subtitle, the only title I had in mind really was Living with Knitting.
I like that.
I liked it too. I thought it was funny, but I think I think that there was little fear. What I heard, the feedback I had about it from the marketing department was that they were afraid, and that's the real key here, people, is that the marketing departments of all these publishing houses are really the ones who are out there titling people's books.
What were they afraid of?
Happens with alarming frequency. But the feedback that I got from them was that they were afraid that people would think that it was like an affliction. And I kept thinking, well, that's the point.
It is.
That's the point. And it's like not lost on any litter. So, you
right.
know, I thought that was kind of funny and unfortunate.
The cover of Knitting Memories, is that the quilt then? That,
it is. That's the blanket that Eleanor knitted and that often is on my own bed.
Yeah, yeah. It's beautiful. It's so beautiful. It's like a knitted patchwork quilt, but kind of a crazy quilt.
It is. It's exactly what it is. It is. It's crazy. And I thought that it was the best blanket in the world until, actually, Eleanor just moved to Los Angeles, and she knitted this other one. She had knitted this to raffle off when her fiancé needed dental work, and he didn't have dental insurance. And then he was, I guess he was upset because it was such a beautiful thing, and he was sorry that it was gone, even though she raised money for his dental work by raffling it off. So she made him another one to compensate. And, you know, I saw it recently, and it just blew my mind. It was just, it was so intricate and had little bits of intarsia and, you know, this and that, and just, like, mind-boggling stuff, 3D stuff dangling off of it. And really sensational, really creative and unique. A really incredible creative brain.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, you know, I'm curious now that you've been writing about food and writing about knitting. Can you see sort of? This might be a strange question, but can you see an end to it, or do you see the more you get into it, the more there is to do with those topics? You know, or do you go, well, you know, I could. You know, write, do another book or two, and then I want to go into, I don't know, wire sculpture and start writing about that.
Well, I think that there's, you know, I never really write about things that don't have anything to do with my life. I mean, I'm a nonfiction writer, but really, I guess if I were to get right down to it, I'd have to say that I'm a memoirist, even though I'm often interested in other people and what they're thinking, but it still comes back to my own interest. But, you know, yeah, you know, I, you never want to anger the gods. The knitting writing has been really good to me and sustained me in times when I really didn't know what else I was doing. I think especially when you become a mother, you can lose your way creatively a little bit, and it's hard to get your brain back, and it's hard to get that momentum back, and it was really... it was a real gift for me to have knitting to write about, and that people were interested in reading what I wanted to write about it. When my brain was just not able to conjure, you know, big, intricate projects about I don't know what. And also, I write about travel too, but we haven't been traveling a whole lot since my daughter was born. So, it's the whole other thing. So, you know, I'm sorry, but that I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's okay.
It's a funny question because on the one hand, yeah, I think I can see an end to. Writing about knitting or writing about food, but also it's also a time of my life kind of thing. You know, I have this daughter who's 3 who's going to go to school, I hope, full-time next year, and then I'll be on the other end of something, and I don't know where I'm going to be spit out, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm, sure. Do you ever find that when maybe people you meet ask you what you do or what you write about, and you say, I don't know what you say, but say, you say, food and knitting, do they take you less seriously, especially of the male species?
You know, it's funny. Men don't ask me a whole lot about what it is that I write. I don't know why. I'm probably running around with a lot of mothers these days without even trying, but... yeah, men don't ask me that much. Although when they do ask me, they tend to have more elaborate questions about it. Knitting, I think that a lot of people hear knitting and they don't knit, and so that's like a cutoff, an end to the conversation potentially.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of men never expected that they would knit, and so they want to know why on earth anybody would write about it.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow it develops into a different conversation.
Sure. Has, you said you're a nonfiction writer. Has it always been so? Did when you were, I know you went to Bennington, when you were in school, did you get into fiction at all, or think that maybe that was a path you would go, or what was that all about?
Well, I was actually a French lit major in college and went with the idea that I would be a painting major, so see where that all led me. But my mother has very distinct memories of me, like, going off to first grade with a brand new marble notebook with a story written on the first few pages. And so I think that writing's been a part of my life literally as far back as I can remember. And when I graduated from college, I got into journalism. I had been doing it a lot. I had been doing it to make money all through college, basically. And I fell into it. It was fun. I liked it. Before I was married and had a family, working for a weekly magazine was a really big, it was a blast. It was a lot of fun. And then I had other things to do with my life. But when I first started writing for myself, I was sort of tinkering with fiction and very soon realized that I had no gift for it. I didn't have stories. I didn't have, there was nothing there. I was just not a fiction writer. And I'm not even sure at the time that I knew there was such a thing, really, like as nonfiction writer. Not that I hadn't read biographies or, you know, travel essays or any of that. I just didn't know that that was something that one did. Writing always seemed to be, if you were going to be a writer, you wrote novels, right? But I had a friend who was a novelist who went to college with me who was like, well, you know, it's not working for you to write fiction. How about nonfiction? And I didn't really know how to start except to start with my family, and I started there and then just started writing about anything that interested me, and it went from there.
Hmm. Yeah, so you kind of just sort of followed yourself. You didn't force yourself to write about, I don't know, fiction if that's, you know, you weren't there.
Right, I mean, well,
it just seems like it's easy to get pulled in certain directions just because. Maybe environment or all of your friends are doing a certain kind of writing, and so you think that's what you should be doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, the lesson for me in my life, writing life or otherwise, is that if I don't really believe it, it doesn't work. It just
mm-hmm.
doesn't work out.
Yeah.
Give up, do something else.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah.
You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. I'm talking with Leila Narji, and we're talking about her various books, Around the Table, Knitting Lessons, Knitting Memories, and we're talking about the process of writing. And I wanted to ask you about writing essays, because you're a wonderful essayist, and you have just, you know, your essays all, you know, I could probably pick up your work and not have your name attached to it and know it was yours. And
I
wonder how do they begin? I mean, do you begin with a theme? Do you begin with an idea? Do you begin with an image? What happens? If you could talk a bit about sort of your process of writing an essay.
Oh, my God, I don't know. that's such a tricky question, and I'm sure that there's a really good answer. And
well, for instance, the Eleanor piece.
A lot of it, you know, again, we have to go back to before my daughter was born, or at least when I had more time that was my own. And I honestly have to say that it begins with pacing my apartment and looking out the window. It begins there, and sometimes a sentence pops into my head, or sometimes I have an idea that I want to write about a particular place. I published a lot of essays about a trip to India that I took with my husband in 1999, and in each instance, there was something very particular that happened in a place that I wanted to explore. And often, you know, I just begin writing and write until I have something, and write until that something is done. And then I go back, and I usually delete the first paragraph of whatever I've written, and, you know, I've buried the lead. My second paragraph is always the opening paragraph, and then I edit it, and then I just work and work and work it.
So in Knitting Memories, the first essay, Living with Eleanor, talk about that one. Talk about, I mean, you had to, I imagine the first thing that happened was that you needed an essay to sort of talk about this book and what the book would be.
Not even the essay. No? The idea for the essay came first, and then I thought, well, this is something that other people might have something to say, to talk about, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it quite literally happened. My husband and daughter and I had been living in Vermont. We moved to Vermont for a brief time, and we're just back in Brooklyn as of July. And I remember very vividly lying in bed under this blanket and thinking, my God, like, what is with that frog? You know, like, what is with that frog? I just, actually I have an idea about the frog, as anybody who reads the essay will find. But, it's all these bits and pieces, and they're beautiful, and they all seem symbolic. And as I was sitting there looking at this blanket, I was recalling this experience I had with Eleanor when she had first brought me the blanket. Or maybe she came back and said something like, well, you figured out what all the bits and pieces mean, don't you? And I was like, what do you mean? I thought it was a frog and a flower and a fish, and it wasn't, because Eleanor, the brain of Eleanor had basically conjured a scenario for every one of these things. And as it turned out, like, one of them was red button swimming pool, where she got that, I have no idea. She had a book of swimming pools, and one of the photographs, a book about swimming pools, and one of the photographs had captured her imagination, and she knitted it up in a swatch. So knowing this about Eleanor, and actually, we were living in Vermont. We were isolated. We had left all of our friends behind, and I was missing them terribly, and I had this blanket, and it was sort of a link to my life in New York and my dear friends here. And it caused me to think about her a lot, and to think about, would I ever puzzle these bits and pieces out? And the answer is no. But it caused me to think about her a lot, and that was its own reward.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay. And then, so you have your essay, and then what sort of revision process do you put it through?
Sometimes it's a short process. It's rare that I have a work of astounding genius right out of the barrel, but I really believe that writing is work. It's work. It's 98% hard work, and a lot of that work is editing, which I happen to like a lot. I think it's really I find it to be a kind of soothing process, but also it's really exciting to see. Things fall away and other things emerge, and the real heart of a piece come out. You know, it's like polishing a piece of marble.
Mm-hmm. We have a few minutes left with Leila Narji on 88.9 FM KUCI. What are you reading now? What are you reading?
What am I reading?
Yeah.
I'm reading a lot of children's books. I'm reading Frog and Toad. Frog and Toad are friends. Everything having to do with children's literature, I have absolutely nothing that I'm reading now. That's The New Yorker, when I get 2 minutes alone in the bathroom, which is almost never.
That's right, a three-year-old.
Yep. So maybe I get through the cartoons with five trips to the bathroom, and then sometimes I have to take the subway into Manhattan, and then maybe I can read half an article. There are some things I think I would like to be reading, but I can't remember where they are or what they are. But I know that I desperately would like to be reading them.
Do you find that when you're writing, whatever you're reading influences it, or does it? Are they just two separate things? Do you watch what you're reading when you're writing?
Yeah, I kind of subconsciously do. I never, and it's funny. I think that probably a lot of writers have the same problem, is that you can. It's not to rip anybody off, but appreciating somebody's writing, you can really sink into the lingo, and pick it up. So I try. Actually, I read a fair amount of fiction, and that's kind of a safe thing to read when you write nonfiction.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. I guess so. I just hit on Eleanor Roosevelt's quote about how fiction is the way you can really tell the truth,
mm-hmm.
Which is interesting. Do you worry about certain things finding their way into your essays because essays are true and perhaps offending somebody or somebody, thinking that they recognize themselves?
No, that's never really been an issue. And it's funny, who was it? A number of years ago, there was a quite well-known nonfiction writer who was absolutely berated and raked over the coals for her admission that not everything in a piece of nonfiction that she wrote was, and she didn't mean to say factually accurate. What she was saying was that you pick and choose things to write about in nonfiction. You can have this experience in a day, but you can't write about every aspect of it, and maybe the sequence is a little different, but you're telling the truth. You're giving the flavor of the event and getting to the core of what happened. And she wasn't saying that she was untruthful in writing nonfiction, but it was interpreted. Who was that? Do you remember? It was a number of years ago. Somebody quite well known.
Catherine Harrison comes to mind with Liars Club, but I don't know.
I don't think it was her, but, you know, and I thought it was so...
Mary Carr, I meant. Sorry.
I'm sorry?
I meant Mary Carr with Liars Club.
Yeah, I don't think it was her.
Yeah.
But, you know, in fiction, you can, I think you have this safety valve. You're writing fiction, and you say that you're writing fiction, and so there is this room for honesty. And in nonfiction, you're sort of picking and choosing what you're going to write about because you still are trying to get at the essential story, and I guess that can be interpreted as non-truth, but then nonfiction isn't journalism. You're not giving a blow-by-blow accounting of something that happened, nor are you obligated to do so.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, of course, there are novels that are basically nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just a little tweaked here and there to, or nonfiction or memoirs that are fictionalized. So
yes, that's been a very popular topic.
It's been really popular.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and it's funny. I went to Bennington College when there were a lot of well-known writers coming out around the time I was graduating, and it's funny to read some of those early novels because there are people who are recognizable in those books. So the fiction of it was always seemed a little bit dubious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think about that? Because I'm thinking that as a nonfiction writer or a memoirist, that you could easily take your experiences and fictionalize them, and you know they would be interesting as they are interesting as nonfiction.
Yeah, I don't know why that doesn't work, but something about the transition that just falls apart for me.
Yeah.
And I don't know if, I won't say that I'm like held down to the truth or anything, but there's just something about the knowledge of the process of writing something that I've experienced that allows me to go forward.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, we are at the end of our time, and I want you to give your website address, which is... LeilaNarghi.com, LeilaNarghi.com.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if you have any sort of advice for the writers who are listening.
Write every day and work hard.
Yeah, every day, that's the thing.
Just a little bit.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. You
right.
know, there was an English writer from the turn of the century who wrote... something like 300 words every day, and sometimes it took him 5 minutes, sometimes it took him half an hour, but he wouldn't stop, he wouldn't do anything else in his day until he'd written those 300 words. Well, you know, maybe that kind of system works for one person, but whatever, write one sentence, write 15, write whatever pops into your head, keep a journal, it doesn't matter. It's writing engenders writing.
Mm-hmm. And staying connected to whatever you're working on.
It's, absolutely.
You know, you let a couple days go by and it starts falling away.
Yep, it sure does.
Thanks so much for coming on the show.
It was my pleasure. It was fun. Thanks for having me.
It was fun. Thank you. It was Leila Narghi. Her books are Around the Table, Women on Food, Cooking, Nourishment, Love, and the Mothers Who Dished It Up for Them, published by Tarcher. I've been reading this book every night before I fall asleep, and it's, I don't know if that's why I wake up hungry, but I do go to sleep with ideas of, I'm going to go out and buy that because I want to make that one. Also, Knitting Lessons is hers, and Tales from the Knitting Path, and Knitting Memories, Reflections on the Knitter's Life. Okay, if you'd like to know more about Writers on Writing, you can go to my website, which is penonfire.com. And as I said earlier, you can link to the podcast from the radio page on my site. I'm going to leave you with a quote by Raymond Carver, actually, who said, Isaac Dinesen said that she wrote a little every day without hope and without despair. I like that. Thanks for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'll see you next time.